welcome to this podcast episode on Leading Beyond Crises. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy of Leadership, known by its German acronym as the IAF. Based in the town of Gummersbach near Cologne, the Academy develops leaders working for partner organizations of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom from all over the world, bringing together experts, opinion leaders, committed young liberals, and aspiring leaders to share specific experiences and knowledge to develop themselves and their organizations, and to explore liberal solutions and responses to public policy challenges. My name is Marika Groenewald, and in today's episode, we're exploring what I think is such a timely topic about disruption and crises in leadership. This time feels so synonymous with volatility, complexity, uncertainty, that we don't really know what tomorrow will bring. And planning and sometimes implementing a plan feels a bit like a futile process that organizations are attached to without really knowing to what impact it will lead. We also know that events taking place all over the world impacts our work even when it's not directly linked. So today we really want to dig into and explore how leaders can respond in such a world beyond just being reactive to whatever crises they're facing in the moment. As always in this conversation, I'm being joined by my friend and colleague, Clinton Depria, as the co-host in today's conversation.
Hello,
Clinton.
Am I not your dear friend today? Okay, I see. We're moving backwards. Okay. Thank you, Marika. And it is my pleasure to off the bat, introduce also our guest speaker, for today, which is Thomas Landthaler. Hello, Thomas.
Hi. Hi to both of you. Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure. Thomas, I came across you on LinkedIn. You had this practice of writing on a whiteboard a thought or something of the day. And I thought that was such a great idea, especially on a platform like LinkedIn, where it feels very formulaic, and you brought something natural. I think that was the first kind of thing that drew me into your ideas and your perspective on things. And then we had the opportunity to meet actually in Berlin as part of one of the IAF seminars earlier this year on strengthening NGOs, which was a highlight. And that's where I actually got to, I think, learn a bit more about your work. I discovered, your background in conflict resolution, in crisis management. You've also been to South Africa, which always, that's the way to get me. But you also wrote a book, Navigating Beyond Crises, which is where the title for today's session comes from. But beyond that, you are a father, you're a facilitator, a lecturer, and a thought leader. And it is such a joy to have you with us today to talk about this idea of what does it actually mean to lead during crises? Well, beyond crises. So I want to hit the road running with the first question. You have a very varied history and professional experience, from the rainforests of Borneo to Afghanistan to the DRC, right in war-torn countries. Can you share with us a little bit about your story? How did that happen? How did it unfold? And how did you end up here now with this area of expertise?
Well, thank you for the kind introduction. And really, again, thanks for having me. And you and the leaders in summer, some of the leaders that you're speaking to, this is very exciting to be able to talk to the two of you. My story is a very diverse one in many ways. I've been a bit around, not so much the past years, but before that. And it all started with me discovering during my studies that I had a very particular passion for conflict. Conflict work. And I always, this sounds, I know it sounds a bit weird, but it was in a training. And also before that, actually, I realized that as a younger, as an adolescent or youth, how you want to say, I always had this, when people were arguing or fighting, I had this urge to go in between. And later on, I started to make more sense when in a training, I was kind of introduced to the whole idea of conflict resolution and mediation, and I was hooked. And this is in a way the profession that I have. So if I have to say like what profession am I trained in or what is actually my professional background, this would be technically my professional background. But as life goes, it's not always as we plan it. I ended up in South Africa. It's my dearest memory in terms of traveling, because that still is to this day the best job I've ever had. And it was a volunteer job. And I was traveling around the Eastern Cape and really being introduced to community mediation. And from then on, I was like, I'm not going back to Austria, which is where I'm actually from. And I explored the rest of the world. And then my first job was in Afghanistan. I stayed there for 2.5 years. I worked both with conflict work before traditional conflict resolution, put in a modern picture. So giving them alternative tools to work around some of the practices that they have. They're not humane. They're not with equal rights for everybody involved. They're quite discriminatory in many ways, giving them alternatives for that. But then I drifted over into crisis management, because a lot of these conflicts are both, they're crisis conflicts, but they're also crisis zones, but also conflicts. So there's this overlap. And I more and more moved into the crisis spheres things. And that's what I did for the next 12 years, pretty much in that nexus between conflict and crisis, until I became a father, which you also mentioned, for the first time. And that's when I realized I was probably worn out, both mentally and physically, because as a young person, you don't really take the time to reflect much about what's happening to you and how you feel about it. But I realized I'm not at home where I should be, kind of mentally and physically, but I'm also not in the field anymore. And that's when I had to reinvent myself and move more into facilitation and competency development. And that's what I've been doing for the past 10 years. And during the pandemic, I decided to finally take the time and reflect a little bit about my approach to crisis management, how I did this back in the day. And that's when I wrote my book. And more or less, the book is kind of also an outline on how I facilitate. It's an outline on how I lead. It's an outline on how I work with disruptive situations.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, that's such a... I mean, I love the golden thread also between that, seeing how the one step leads to the next, which is always fascinating when you speak to people about their career trajectory. And I'm wondering if you can share with us, if we think about leadership, because this is a leadership focused podcast as well, how would you say those different aspects of your journey, how have those impacted your understanding or your view of leadership, especially in times of uncertainty?
I think this is just such a great question, because I have a lot of issues with how we talk about leadership. So particularly the whole idea that there is one form of leadership, right? Whether we call it transformational leadership or situational leadership or all these different theories behind it and research. I think that's all putting leadership in a box. What I've learned in my journey and what I've learned for myself and also working with other leaders later on is that what makes it so special, leadership, is actually the uniqueness of us. So we're all different and we're all beautifully different. And taking that away from people by putting them in boxes and say, like, now you have to be a transformational leader, makes people think too much about what leadership is. It makes kind of the whole idea a bit streamlined, which I think is sad, because also the people who are leading are not all the same. So when I sometimes in my workshops, when I ask people to think about the most inspiring leader they've ever had and why they were inspiring, that's when we find out, oh, there's very different things and could be the same people, but we're looking for different things. So leadership is highly individual. That's one thing I've learned. And the other thing is also that we're not leading situations. We're actually leading people in the situations. And that's just a minor tweak and reframe, but it's a crucial one, because especially when we talk about disruption or when we talk about crisis, it's so easy to get lost in the context, in the factors that we can't influence. But then in front of us, there are people. And it's actually the people who will eventually lead through that situation. It's not, we are not alone. But if you don't know how to manage human dynamics and actually focus on really people first, you will get into trouble. So that's the second thing. And maybe a third thing, just quickly to add, is that that leadership is also, it's not something we do alone. So that's the thing, like I might lead in a situation, but in another situation, somebody else from my group or the team that's present is way better suited to lead us through this. So it's also about letting go. It's about not holding on to position or to status or to the fear of not being important anymore at the moment I give the baton to somebody else, but actually saying like, well, you know what? Now it's your turn to shine. And I'm just here and actually being led at the moment. So it's this constant back and forth between leaders and followers and kind of change of roles. That's the third thing I'd add.
Your response makes my heart sing. Because I think there's such richness in acknowledging the diversity of the world. And in this time, we spoke a little bit at the beginning of the conversation about this time of complexity crisis, there's also a tendency to be quite inward looking at the moment, to almost turn away from diversity because diversity perhaps feels difficult to navigate. And when I listen to your journey, Thomas, it sounds like you've had such a gift of being exposed to all these contexts and communities that's so vastly different, I imagine, from your own. I know that some of the leaders who are listening to this conversation perhaps might see the same kind of archaic, formulaic leadership behaviors play out in their organizations. So leaders behaving in the same way to the different crises, but same response over and over again, almost the opposite of diversity and of embracing the complexity of changing your position on something. I'm wondering whether there's a story you can tell or an experience you've had where you saw people succeed in changing their perspective and their position and therefore embrace their own diversity in how to respond to a crisis instead of just mimicking or doing the same thing that they've always done.
The great points. I mean, first a word to the introspection. I think what is so sad to see is that we do this either or. So we don't combine the things we're exposed to or the things we're confronted with and then introspect in relation to that. We introspect and then we're afraid of change because we focus on ourselves and we hold on to what we have. And that kind of brings me also to the examples and to the situations that I've experienced a lot, which is the first thing I often hear when we work with crises, when I support leaders in crisis, is that I feel like I'm losing control. That's usually the first thing that comes. And as a response, people have a tendency to hold on to that, what they know. And that could be the behavior that they've shown all the time, because now it's not the time to change also that. So they need something to hold on to. And that's what they try to control something. And that's when they resort to the things that they know, the automatisms that they go through. I've worked with a leader over the past year who had this team. They were really willing to, the whole organization was facing pretty much a rough crisis, was a scale up. But the interesting thing was, it was a homemade problem. So they were used from the beginning, start of the company, they were used to solving all the issues in the leadership team. And that was at the beginning of the pandemic when we had a conversation and he said, like, we're almost going bankrupt. Now, as a background information, that company was selling digital communication services. So something that in the pandemic, everybody needed. But they were about to go bankrupt. And then we looked a little bit into their behavior. So how are you handling this? And said, like, well, we're sitting in meetings the whole day. It's like, who is there? Well, it's the CEO and, you know, all the top leadership. So I'm like, okay, so who is working with your teams? Who is leading them? And he was just sitting there, like, not understanding what I'm actually asking. Like, well, you're also leading a team. So who is leading them when you're in these meetings? And he said, like, nobody, I don't know. I'm like, there you might have an issue, right? Because the first thing you need to do is you need to accompany your float, because otherwise you don't need to save anything because there's nothing to save. So that's when they started to really change that and say, like, because what they understood is that these top leaders, they held on to the control that they had. And they had the feeling that when they sat together in that meeting, they had control. but they lost the sight of everything around them. What I mentioned before, they lost the sight that there's other people who have lots of resources to bring to maybe how to handle the situation, and that their job is actually to keep it alive as leaders. So, and they started to change that. They started to open up, and they started a few meetings, and the meetings actually conducted different people, and all of a sudden they turned things around, and they really are doing really well now. And we often go back to this simple switch where he said, like, well, I realized that having responsibility is not the same as having to lead, having to fix everything yourself. And that's when the switch happened.
Mm. And this thing about feeling like you have to fix everything yourself, and that you're responsible for everything, you have to take ownership of everything. I see a lot of leaders in organizations really struggle with that, and struggling to hand over the baton of co-responsibility to the people they lead. And then sometimes also being stuck in organizational kind of vagueness. So you don't really know what you're handing over. You use the word, something that Clinton and I think a lot about, meetings quite frequently, that the very vehicle that is designed as a way to get to clarity often leads to the opposite of that. And so leaders rely on these conversations with the people they follow that happen in these organizational vehicles on a recurring basis. And instead of leading to clarity, collaboration, supporting one another, connection, trust, progress, it very often leads to the opposite and becomes like a blunt instrument. I liken it to a TV dinner. We plug it into everything and we think, but it's not nourishing, it's not pleasant for anybody. And yeah, how do we transform organizational conversations into things that work?
I think we have to explore mental models. This is one of my favorite activity to do. Mental models for some of the listeners are basically fundamental assumptions about how the world works. And we have some of them that we know about, some of them that we're very vocal about, like maybe our values, even though I also would encourage everybody listening to sit down and write down your values and then go a bit lower and say, like, why is that actually a value? Where did it start? Where did it come from? Make like almost a value map, so to say, because you will be surprised what you will discover. But the point is also that we know of these, but then we have a lot of mental models, a lot of fundamental assumptions that we only find out about when they're challenged, when we meet someone who has a very different one. And I like to tell that little story when I was in South Africa. That actually happened when I had kind of my first real conscious encounter with one of my own mental models. And that was at a dinner where I was invited. And my friends were there, but there were also a few people I didn't know. And then there was this young man sitting down opposite me at the dinner table. We were about to start eating, and he was wearing a hat. And I had this inner reaction, like, this is wrong. And I heard my father standing behind me, like, we don't wear hats at the dinner table. Like when I was having my cap as a 16-year-old, when it was glued to my head, kind of. And I was like, I had a physical reaction to, this is not possible, right? We can't kind of eat before you take off your hat, almost. And that's when I understood, you know, this is my reality. This is not everybody's reality. And those mental models we also have in organizations. And in organizations, they show themselves in the organizational culture. Many of the listeners might have experienced that when you start a new job and you're actually hired for, you know, rattling the cage a little bit and bringing in new ideas. But one of the first things you might hear is, this is always how we have done it. These are mental models. And what I often work with organizations is exploring those. It's like, what are the things that you have, what are the fundamental beliefs that you carry in your organization that makes you work or do what you do? Because, and this brings us a bit to the uncertainty and the disruption, because that's where the disruption comes in. If you're not aware of them, that's when we are disrupted, when they're challenged, when all of a sudden the world looks different from what we're used to, and our beliefs don't match anymore what we have to do. And by exploring them, you actually get a lot of opportunity to rework them, to rethink them, to actually consciously decide to move onwards with them. But you're aware, and you know, and you make yourself less vulnerable. And this is always a good starting point to have these open conversations and dive a bit deeper.
Mm.
How would you define disruption? Let's talk about it. So what is your mental model of the word disruption?
I thought a lot about this, so thank you very much for this question. For me, start one step earlier, because when people ask me about crises, right? When we all think about like what crisis is, we have lots of different answers. And I already challenge in my book the standard definitions of crisis and going a bit back to the early definition where it was more or less just a turning point. It wasn't negative like we use it now, but it's a period of time where decisions need to be made that the system that leads to systemic changes. This is how would I define it. But the problem that crises have and why they make it so difficult for us is because they're disruptive. And now to your question, the disruption for me is a very exciting thing because in England, in English, and particularly in English, it means two things. It means the cause of something and it means the effect of something. And for me, disruption has three layers. One is the origin. That can be an incident. It can be, you know, the context changing, a decision. Doesn't matter. It can be your phone ringing in your pocket. We experience disruption all the time. It's just not always disruptive for us. So you have that side. And then you have two other layers. One is a mental layer. It's basically our assessment of whatever happens to us. Is this a threat? Is this dangerous? Is this bad? Is this good? So the first thing that kicks in, and there the mental models play a role. So, and this is also why I started with crisis, because our, when somebody shouts crisis, we have immediately a negative mental model. And that blocks us, right? So that influences what happens afterwards. So that's why I'm trying to fight a little bit against that. And the third layer is how we respond to it. Are we equipped how to react to that disruption? Positively, negatively, however we assess it before. And that's where the skills come in, the toolbox pretty much. And ironically, I experience in my work that we spend most of the time thinking about the origin, the cause, the context, which is where we have the least influence. So there's a lot of energy that goes into nothing. And we feel naturally as we have no control over things because that's what we have when we focus on the context. But the other two layers, the mental assessment and the reaction, there we have lots of opportunities. And that's why I'm trying in my work, working with disruption advice, and I've moved away from the crisis management, but really move on like, What is it doing with you? I try to prepare leaders and teams and companies for how to be able to work with that disruption and actually turn it into something that you either might not feel or that you're able to work with, or in the best case, even turn to your advantage. So those are the three things.
Can I ask, you say we're stuck in step one, thinking about the origin of a disruption. Why do you think that is? Is it because we're trying to, in a way, understand or perhaps create a mental model about it, or trying to fit in an existing mental model to see, therefore, what we can do? Or is it just, I don't know, stuck in story mode, our brains, you know, perhaps propensity to create meaning and therefore, you know, find a narrative that therefore fits so that maybe we can find a solution we've used in the past. What is that about?
Those two things are definitely reasons. Another reason is we always need to understand things. So we look always for an origin. Why did something happen? A reason, a starting point, a cause. So our minds are trained like that. And the moment we go there, so in the pandemic, many people said, my problem are the travel restrictions. Sure, but can you do anything about it? No, but still people get upset about it. There's also the emotional response, which kind of becomes then this cycle, right? So we're moving in. Another thing, which is often it's us dodging the responsibility or actually facing our mirror. Like, are we equipped to deal with this or not? So we go a lot into, so it's somebody else's responsibility. So we are the victims of this. And it happens to me, right? So it becomes quickly this like, I'm poor me. I'm exaggerating a bit, but poor me, this happens to me, right? Yeah. But what that does in return is it really does make us feel like we can't do anything about it. And the interesting thing is when you flip that, when you work with teams and you say like, so what's your problem? And they start with, for example, the travel restrictions. And then you're really like, okay, why are the problems and so on? And it's all external focused. So they're not focused on the zone of leverage, as I call it, the impact of what they can control. But we try then to flip it. And when I slowly move them, you see that something changes in the team. Because first it was almost this like motivation is gone and they don't know what to do. And it's all, the world is really dark. I share a short example about how we use this in a little experiment. We exposed two groups to do two different memos. They were playing like a management team of a company. And one memo was, it was from the board of that company. And one memo was basically outlining, yeah, we're in a crisis and situation is really difficult and we have no information and it's challenging. And it was rather dark formulated, not very negative, but rather like sober. And yeah, the other one was in the exact same crisis, but the memo was formulated in the sense of like, this is a very challenging time for us, but we have full confidence in you. We know that we have the skills, we're creative, we'll find ways, we're committed. And they were to draft a short response. These responses couldn't have been more different. Like the one that was rather sober and negative, they were also responding very negatively in the sense of like, we're just monitoring the situation. We'll keep you updated. We haven't really taken any steps yet because we don't know what to go. So they became a playing ball of the context. The others, they got no information about what they were really doing. They gave us already 10 points of actions they're going to do. And so like, we're going to go for this, right? And this was just very different responses because they didn't get stuck in the context. While they were completely prisoners to the context. And all it did was just a formulation that we had.
It reminds me a bit, and I want to check if this is what you're saying. It reminds me of, you know, what Hannah Arendt says about language, that language is not descriptive. It doesn't just tell us what the world is around us, but it is also generative. It creates the world based on the words that we use. And I'm getting a sense that that's what you're talking about, that in the choice of words, we're also choosing how to view a situation.
Absolutely. That's a perfect example for that. I think we become what we say we become. And the thing today is that I always like to say we live in a world of aftertruth because there is no universal truth anymore, or there are only universal truths if you want, because it's never in history been so easy to have access to information. So you have access to tons of truths out there, but it's also never been easier in history, even though we've seen it before, what's happening right now all over the world, to mobilize people. And sadly, like I've written a paper about it. I was on Twitter. I wasn't on Twitter in the beginning. I was one of the late joiners, and that was 2017, I think. My experiment lasted 2 weeks because I turned into the absolute worst version of myself. Like what happens on this platform, the way we communicate there is, it's just, it showed me also, it's so simple to negatively mobilize, while it's so difficult to positively mobilize, because you use way more words to convey positive emotion than you need to convey negative emotion. And Twitter is the perfect example for that, because you can get triggered by one word while you can then get untriggered by one word. So there's a lot of these psychological processes that I think what you quoted by Hannah Arendt, this is a very good point.
I want to turn a little bit to the work of the IAF, specifically around its mandate in the world to develop leaders. And one of these buzzwords that we work a lot with is this word resilience. And I have my own strong feelings about our drive to convince leaders to be more resilient and sometimes in impossible situations, and whether that is responsible, but that's not the direction I want to have this conversation in with you. I'd love to explore a little bit your attachment/work with the word readiness over the word resilience. What for you is the distinction, and why is it important to make that distinction?
I think resilience is a wolf in sheep's clothing, I would say, because the problem with the word resilience is that we have the idea that we can build this for the future. Now, the problem is we don't know the future. So we don't know what it's going to throw at us. We don't know how we are going to show up when it throws something at us. And so I moved away, because I used to work with resilience a lot, but I moved away from it when I reflected on what it actually says. And the idea of building resilience beforehand means that I know what the future is going to hold. Because when I really am honest, I could only judge myself whether I was resilient in retrospect. It's like, how did I handle that situation? So for me, always like I don't go in and say like, you know, we're gonna build your resilience, even though the things that we might be doing might be contributing to that you're going to be resilient in the future, I wouldn't go as far as to say like you, I'm help you become a resilient leader. But what for me is a different concept. Also, feel like maybe to also add that I also don't talk about preparedness, because that is also one of these wolves in sheep clothing, because it's kind of, speaking of communication psychology, it gives you the feeling that you're prepared at one point, which makes you lower your shoulder and which makes you stop kind of to continue what you're doing. Also, for preparedness, you have to actually have something to prepare for, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. You're preparing into the dark. So this is where readiness comes in, because readiness kind of incorporates all of these elements. But readiness is also the element of being on alert. And by alert, I don't mean like, you know, high pulse all the time, but it means you feel like whatever you're thrown at, you're able to handle. So we're talking about basically the layer 2 and 3 here, right? The mental assessment, as I mentioned before, when it comes to disruption, and the action. And for me, readiness is that. Readiness is a active state of being prepared. And it's also a toolbox of increasing the potential that you're going to be resilient when something happens. And that's what I combine in readiness. And for me, the way I work with this is very simple. It's just habits, as I call it. Habits that you then automatically do when you're faced with disruption or challenging situations, but that will help you navigate through it.
I think many of the listeners to this podcast are in organizations that needs a really high level of readiness because of the enormously challenging contexts and situations they face. Very often when we work with them, we encounter them saying things like, we didn't know how to respond to the situation, or we tried that 5 years ago, we're trying it again this year, or our leaders are rolling out the same campaign in this election as the previous one, expecting a different result. Thomas, in your work, are there things that people can look out for that are the opposite of readiness? So can they, in a way, almost diagnose their organization?
It's a fantastic question. I don't think I've ever had that question before. And the reason why I like it is because it flips from what we say we should do to what we say we should look for. I think there's many things they can look for. One of them is routines. And for me, I make a very clear distinction between routines and habits, because for me, routines are doing the same thing the same way all the time. And habits is doing the same thing differently all the time. And as facilitators, we know, we have, for example, if somebody works with check-ins, the check-in might look different every time. It's still a habit. You still do the same thing, but you do it differently. And what that does, it actually keeps you alert. It keeps you more motivated, keeps you curious. So all these mental things that play into the idea of readiness are there. So routines are the opposite. If I know and I know exactly what to do, I mean, my brain switches off. So I'm not ready anymore. And of course, there are routines when it comes to responding to crisis, which are important when there's really protocols involved. Like, you know, a pilot or pilots should check their plane every time the same, right? This is not what I'm talking about. I'm really talking about situational response here, the flexibility that you try to get into. The other one that definitely is there is like how decisions are being made, how you talk about decisions and how decisions are being made. Is it clear, or do we have assumptions that we know how decisions are being made in an organization? And very often, if not almost always, it's the latter. When you ask people in organizations, like, how are decisions being made here? The answer might be like, well, our leader decides. But this is not even the point, because there we're talking just about the final aspect of a decision. How are decisions being prepared? How is the information shared? How inclusive is the whole process? What is actually the focus of a decision? Are you aiming to make the best possible decisions? Because you're going to be lost, because we never, similar to resilience, we never know whether it was a good decision until we've taken it. It's all assumption based. So maybe look for confident decisions and see like, okay, that in that situation, that's the best decision I can take, rather than looking for the right decision, the best decision, and so on. So that's something to look for. How are people included? How are we talking about internal communication, right? How is there positive honesty? Or is there rather, are things kept in the dark? And also here, I think the distinction between honesty and transparency is very important, because that's not the same. And often people put that in the same pot. It's not that because I'm honest doesn't mean I have to say everything, but whatever I say has to be honest. This is the distinction. And if you then turn it with a positive twist, like at the end, you know, I believe that we're going to get through this, or I'm convinced about it, or that just does something to people. Mm-hmm. So these are small things that you can look out for, where you say, like, if these are maybe not in place or maybe not as developed in your organization, there's potential to work with it.
Mm.
I love this distinction between a routine and a habitual practice. I've never thought of that distinction between the two, that the one is just repetitive and the other one is also repetitive, but doing it better in a way. That makes absolute sense. It's almost like these are what you've just listed are organizational red flags, if we can name it this way. You've also touched on some organizational green flags, confident decision making. You know, we can flip it. I'm wondering if there are other organizational green flags that people can look out for, that they can say, oh yeah, this is, we're doing this right, we're getting this, or we can do more of this.
Is, again, I've turned them into habits in my book, right? So these green flags. So one thing that of course comes to mind immediately is, how does the organization learn? And very often, and you might have experienced this, I'm sure you've experienced this yourself in your roles, is that learning is a separate activity from everything else. So basically you do something, then you sit down and evaluate it and learn from it, then you document the learning, and then you move on. I think learning is a constant process. It's constantly happening, but that also means we have to find ways of constantly implementing the learnings along the way. So when I used to work with crisis management, we had this constant updates of, like, so what do we take from us from this, and not looking always for what doesn't work, because this is also a mental model we have. Learning is all about things that don't work, but look for things that actually do work, because those things you might actually keep, protect, continue. And those also might be, at the end of the day, the things that got you through the crisis, but we never talk about it. So learning is something that is also very, very important. And do all levels learn? Because I also very often see that the learning is pushed to the lower levels. And the top level, how are they involved in learning other than never reading a report that they're being sent to? So that's something. Does the company stay in their own bubble? By that I mean, like, is a accounting company, are they only thinking about accounting and their competition when it comes to accounting? Or are they here and there looking into other sectors and say, like, so what can we actually learn maybe from a bakery, right? Or what can we learn from, it doesn't matter. But really, like, open up a bit and see, is there anything else out there? Because that will also help you. And as a final point, I encourage leaders, the leaders that are listening, to go into the companies and find out how well they know their resources. And we've talked about this in summer, if you remember, Clinton, and I think that's one of the biggest blind spots that I see often in companies. They are not aware of their resources. So you ask them what they have, and the first thing they will list is, of course, materialistic resources, right? Some might even include time into this. They talk about human resources, how many people they have, but that every single human is thousands of resources in every single human, that is overlooked, right? So really learn how to map your resources and have an overview of what you have available, because in a crisis, everything is a resource. And if you don't think you have anything, which many companies do, you will always look to the outside and you make yourself vulnerable, you make yourself dependent, and you actually lose a lot of time by doing that. So those are a couple of green flags, again, if you flip it, right? Mm.
I remember this, the exercise you did about the resources, and I also remember you kind of having to gently prod the group forward, because it's so difficult to recognize, or I would suppose to let go of your definition and your mental model of what a resource is. Mm-hmm. And I remember the grid that you did with finite, infinite, I can't remember the other two now.
And tangible, intangible.
Tangible, intangible. Yes, yes, yes. And the kind of struggling with the intangible but infinite resources. And people were like, it's so challenging. And I think one of the moments when the dam walls, so to speak, broke was when someone started listing languages. They're like, oh, how many languages can we speak in this group? And suddenly there was, you know, 10 additional resources. So if there's something happening, hey, we've got all these languages. And I remember this discussion in the group that we had about how many of you know all the languages that the people in your organization speak, because that is a resource that can be tapped into. And that was a kind of a breakthrough moment for me as well, in exposing one of my mental models, I suppose. And I'm struck as I listen to you about this, and I can imagine that people listening to this conversation also perhaps finding themselves in a position where they themselves are in charge and the responsibility is on them to create this culture of learning, of openness, to think about what are the habits that we bring into organizations to create habitual readiness. They have the levers of power with them. What can someone do that finds themselves in an organization where they don't have the influence of that leader? Perhaps they manage a team within an organization, but they're not the CEO. And they can create a culture of learning downward, so to speak, within their team, within their bubble. But perhaps they're struggling upward. How do you change or start to change that and to create that culture of learning?
This is a very common challenge, of course.
Yeah.
What I notice when I work with leaders and teams like that is that the ambition level is too high. So it's almost like, you know, how can we kind of make this trickle over in the organization? Don't start there, because that means you have left out a few steps how to even get to that point. Mm. First, as a manager or a mid-level leader or however you want to call it, start with the people around you and start really like implement those habits in your team. So don't think about the organization as the first step, but make your team ready. You and your team. It starts with you anyway. Like it always starts with ourselves. So really identify your own mental models about leadership, for example, or about how the group has to interact. And because we all have that. And when you come in, particularly new leaders suffer often from that they have to put their stamp on it, right? So I'm a football fan, and that's very often like a new coach comes in and they have to immediately make an impact, right? They might put the star player on the bench to kind of prove it. So there's a couple of those things. So start with yourself and identify that, but then play with your team and never forget that you're not alone. So it's not your own responsibility to change something. You have maybe six people who are, however big your team is, you have these people around you. And each of them has so much to contribute to make this happen. So your job as a leader is not to change everything. Your job as a leader, and that brings us a bit back to where we started this conversation, is to actually work with the people for them to help you make a change. So how can I make people shine? How can I make the space that they want to interact? How can I share responsibility? Like we never share responsibility as leaders because we think, yeah, I will be held accountable. Yes, that's part of the leader, but it doesn't mean that all you have to do everything yourselves. So that's the first thing. Start with the small steps. Try to do a small thing. Meetings, we spoke about that. Maybe just try to open the meeting with a funny exchange on perspectives. Doesn't even have to be a working topic, but just open up and see how the team reacts. And then you try this and then say like, okay, to at the end of the meeting, you say to the colleague on the right or left, you say like, okay, next time it's your turn to find a funny opening for this meeting. So it must be all about exchanging perspectives. Go for it and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And then you, from then on, you steer, you're already on the way, right? And I like that little metaphor that a stone is always easier to roll when it's already rolling. It's just that first push that often is the difficult thing. And that we overthink. There we already go like, okay, how can we make a big impact? Don't make a big impact. Get the stone rolling. Mm. Try something and see if it works. Because the moment you tried something, it's already rolling.
It reminds me as I'm listening to you of something that we say a lot, Clinton, is reality includes that which is going well.
Mm.
Yep. And I think when we're in a crisis, it's so hard to also keep an eye on that. When you're leading and you're working with people, you're in the business of working with potential and possibility. And then reality, despite the crisis, despite our response to it, despite the breakdown or the interruption that we're facing, also includes these beautiful resources in the capacity of people and their ability to see themselves in a specific way. What do you use for yourself? And use is maybe not the right way, but when you feel stuck in a situation where you struggle to see that reality includes that which is going well, how do you push yourself out of that?
Three things that I do. One thing that I would add to the list that you've said when we work with people is maybe the biggest flawed mental model that I know in crisis management, which is that we have to be rational and we have to kind of leave our emotions aside. It's not working that way. And for all the leaders here, like one of the biggest advices I can give you, learn how to make space for emotions for yourself. That brings me back to your question, and for the team. Because what I've learned to do is I've learned to acknowledge my emotions. And really try to name them. It's like, what's happening in me right now? Am I overwhelmed? Am I scared? Am I embarrassed? There's so many emotions we're going through when there's situations like that. But they all become this one, like, oh, yeah, let's just push this aside. Don't do that, because they will come back and haunt you. But what I then practically do is I use a technique that I label as incubation. So basically, when I'm really stuck, I remove myself from the problem. And I just go for a walk, or I do something completely different that doesn't really preoccupy much of my brain, but gives it a break, because there's this beautiful ability that our brain has that it continues working on the problem until it's solved. That's the difficult things when, you know, we have something at the tip of our tongue and we don't get to it and all of a sudden it's there, but it comes usually when we don't think about it. Or these ideas that we have in the shower, or we're driving a car, or, you know, the best ideas that all of a sudden come from somewhere.
Or that's the comeback same mechanism that you have to what someone said a day later, and you're like, oh, I should have said that. That would have really...
That's a beautiful example too. Yeah, that's a very annoying one. We're like, oh, I should have said that. But that's exactly how our brain works, right? So it doesn't let go until it actually understands, okay, we don't have a solution, or it has a solution. And that helps by removing ourselves. And often I hear in crisis, we don't have time. We always have time. If it's not a life or death situation, or you have to react immediately, there is always time. Third thing that I do is that I reframe the problem. So I don't start it with the problem is, or my problem is. I always start with, like, what can I do about? And the moment you ask what can I do about, and then add something on, and the answer is nothing, it's not your problem. So you have to kind of reframe it until you come to a point where you're like, okay, there is something I can do about this. And because then you immediately refocus on your zone of influence, your zone of leverage. And you all of a sudden have that control back that you're missing so much. And it gives you a boost, because it's like, okay, I actually have options here. That's what I do when I'm stuck.
Well, that's enormously helpful. And yeah, this removing yourself from the problem, taking a walk, making space for, I suppose, things that sometimes feel counterintuitive to what you should be doing in a crisis, is by stepping away from the crises.
Sorry to jump in here, just choke, because there are physical reactions connected to it. When we're stuck, right? But when we laugh, like, we open up and it comes looser, and you have, like, all of a sudden more energy again. And again, you also remove yourself from the problem. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you, but that was one thing that came to mind.
No, it's brilliant that you did. Because, you know, we're not just floating heads. We are bodies. We have nervous systems. And the people we work with are also not just floating heads filled with rational thoughts. If only. But isn't that interesting? Because I think especially in this audience, when we think about liberal thinkers, there is a tendency to feel very proud about the rationality of liberal thought. I want to just briefly touch on something you said around making time, and people saying things like, we don't have time for this. It's also sometimes something you come across in when you try to support people to design meetings better. They would say something like, you know, we don't have time to have a proper check-in for connection. We need to get to the work. Or that's a nice to have, or it's something soft. Let's skip the airy fairy thing. So we have all these, what I think facilitators listening to this conversation would experience as deeply offensive terminology. And all of us know that these are in fact the very hard skills in life to master. I think one of the opportunities available to organizations is to break the organizational rhythm. To put a crack in how things are scheduled and the assessments and assumptions we have around whether or not we have time and whether or not we are in fact as busy and as important as we think we are. Does that resonate with you? How do we make time for these things that maybe in the organization are seen as not so important, but that can in fact be the thing that changes everything?
I had to smile because of course that I've heard that many times before. We don't have this. And I've heard this as a facilitator too by groups that I worked with and probably both of you as well. It's like, okay, let's get to the real stuff. And in organizations, the simplest advice that I can give is practice not to have time. And by that, I mean just insert artificial constraints. Something that would usually take an hour takes half an hour now, and see what happens. Because you then understand how much time you actually need on take on things that might not be relevant for what's happening now. So the next time when you have an hour, that argument doesn't work anymore.
Mm.
It's like, we don't have time for this. And so like, okay, now we take 5 minutes for this. The other thing is learn from facilitators. This is our job, right? So we make these things, again, habits. Because we can take a check-in, but everybody has their mental model about what a check-in is. I never work with check-ins because I, as a participant, I'm not a big fan of them. But there's also other ways of doing it, right? And if somebody likes check-ins, they have lots of ideas on how to do a check-in. And as a leader, as a manager, there's lots to learn from facilitators on group dynamics, on keeping people engaged, on including people, on ending maybe on an exciting note so that the energy is taken from the meeting. Lots of things to learn there. I think there's just a bit of a gap between our profession and between leaders in the world, because they're like, okay, when you come in, you're an external. It's like, no, but the skills that we're using are not different. We're just applying them differently. So look at facilitation. There might be lots of tricks on how you can actually work with time super effectively. Even if you have a little time, there's always space for that.
I want to stick with this theme of facilitation that has popped up, and maybe tie it also to what you said just now about making space for emotions. And that is one of the trickiest things of facilitators and leaders, is working with, well, first acknowledging and then working with the emotions that are in the room, and in real time having to A, redesign the program in your head or the agenda that you had set up for this gathering, or if you're a leader, the meeting that you had. Now something happens which causes a disruption. And then you have to decide, how do I handle this now? Do I shove it to the side? You, of course, well, I think all three of us would agree that's not the way to go. So you then work with it. How do you... I don't know what is it feels too simple a question to ask. How do you work with emotions? Yeah. I suppose my bigger question is, how do you in your mind think about acknowledging the emotions, but then designing it or facilitating it, leading it to a way where you can work with useful emotions, or where you can get yourself to a place where perhaps it's a restoration, or it's a... Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I know what you're asking. And correct me if the answer is really completely off. I think what I hear from leaders is like, you know, this is a serious business. Emotions have no space, and that's almost being in a state of denial. What we underestimate is that the important functions that emotions have. Because they are basically our guides and our guardians and basically also the backpack where the solutions are hidden. This is a little bit already answer to your question. Because if you explore an emotion, it's where you often find the answer. And leaders want their teams to be united and they want their teams to be going in the same direction and so on. Now, if people have different emotions, and that already happens when you throw in, for example, the term crisis, they have different responses because we all see that differently. And you're not exploring the emotions, they might just all go in different directions, because what the emotion is, it tells you what people seek in that situation. And if you as a leader or if the other team members don't know what you seek, you might just go in a completely different direction and you exactly don't have what you want, that the team moves together. And when I'm often, and then when the leader said, well, but it takes a lot of time to work with emotion. No, it takes exactly 2 minutes. Take a step back, what I like to call the magic moment, and do a tour. And like really start like, how are we feeling right now? And ideally you start yourself and acknowledge, I'm scared. And when leaders often think like, I can't show weakness or can't, and in some cultures that might be listening to, this is actually a real big thing. Mm. You just formulate it in a different way so that everybody understands what you're saying, because it's more important. It's not undermining your leadership. This is a misconception. It's actually saying, I'm not scared to say that I am scared right now, but I want to know from all of you what's going on. Because if I say as a leader, like, I'm not scared, the next person will say, I'm not scared, but so you don't have what you need. And when you said acknowledgement, I think that's a very important thing. Acknowledgement is often enough, because you can then very clearly, that's where the rationality might kick in, say like, okay, I can hear that we're scared, we're worried, and that is space, but we might not have space to explore all of that right now until somebody really needs it. I've never experienced that except for one case, but that was really, really severe issue. It's like, if we really need this, we take breaks. But otherwise, are we ready? Are we good to move on? And people, when they feel seen, they're very quickly ready to move on, because they were heard, they're seen, and they're not forgotten. What you have when you don't do that, and I like that metaphor with a boiling pot of water. If the pot is open and it boils, yeah, it's hot. But if you put a lid on it, it's going to boil over. And that's the same with emotions. That's what happens when you don't deal with them in any way. And leaders overcomplicate in their mind because of our mental models becoming adults. There's shame in it. We don't know how to deal with people who are super eccentric. So we have all these like crazy visions about what's going to happen if we open up emotions. People are going to start crying all over the place. You would be surprised. That's not the case. And if they cry, they'll be very ready afterwards to do even more. So there's no shame in that either. Mm. So don't be scared of it.
And I suppose it's also about... If you find yourself in a place thinking, oh my goodness, what if they cry? What if they,
yeah,
that in itself, that response that you're having to that thought is for me an invitation to go deeper into yourself then and ask yourself, why am I having this response to the possibility of that response? So what is it in me that is afraid of that, that is anxious about that? Is it that I think I won't be able to handle it? Is it that, you know, things will spiral out of control or da 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 da? And that, I think, is such another assumption or an opportunity for assumptions to come to the front.
But you will find our mental models. That's where you will find mental models. Whether you come from a cultural background where it's not allowed to cry, or where you have to be the strong man, because we are very prone to that on as men, of course. But it's also the moment you go deeper, you understand that you understand yourself better, and you understand the limitations that you're putting up. And unfortunately, in disruptive situations, the responsibility feels a lot bigger. And that is a way bigger blocker for working with emotions and so on. If I have no pressure, sure, bring it on. But if I have a lot of pressure, you also feel like I'm going to fail, right? You have that additional pressure from that side. And then you have your own pressure. Like, I don't want to deal with anybody who cries because I don't know how to do it. Doing something wrong. Acknowledging an emotion can never be wrong. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, there's something incredibly releasing about acknowledging, naming an emotion and seeing something for what it is. Thomas, to wrap up this conversation, is there something that you read this year that provoked thinking for you that you might want to recommend to our listeners?
Yes. I mean, I read a lot this year and kind of they all provoke thinking in their own way. But But I had my own share of experiences with indigenous communities around the world and First Nations. And I read this year, it's not from this year, but I read it this year finally, the book Sand Talk by Tai Simyom Kompuda, an Aboriginal author and scholar and researcher, where he explains or tries to explain the concepts, some of the original Aboriginal concepts to the extent that you can explain them and how they work and why they kind of would be relevant for today's world. Very thought-provoking for me. I have a history particularly with the First Nation Australians. So for me, this was more or less a almost like a flashback and really a reminder of a lot of the concepts that I had already learned once, but where I was definitely too young and too inexperienced to dive into them. Very good book. Can just recommend it. It will blow and twist your mind.
Brilliant. And we'll make sure to include that in the show notes too. Thank you so much for that suggestion. And I would like to just take a moment to appreciate you and the depth and the richness of thought that you brought to this conversation. If I think about the topics we spanned, everything that was planned and unplanned to discuss today. But yeah, the place of genuine curiosity from which you lead and how tangible that is, we really appreciate it. Thank you for sharing that with us today.
I can just mirror that right back. I think in a conversation, it's all about like how you come together and meet in curiosity. And I think your questions were wonderful. They actually, as I said, some of them I had actually never been asked. So thank you for creating this beautiful space. And thanks again for having me share it.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure. This episode forms part of the IAF podcast series that accompanies regular seminar programs of the International Academy for Leadership in Gummersbach in Germany. We invite you to listen out for our other episodes, and please do share your thoughts in response. If you keep an eye on the work of the IAF on social media, you will be very well informed about the amazing initiatives and programs of the Academy. Till next time. Thank you.